Ave Podcast listeners, a quick notice before we get started with today's episode. To begin with, we are crowdfunding a podcast miniseries on the life and career of the Roman general Agricola. It's 5 episodes, will be available to supporters only, and you can find that now on Kickstarter. There'll be a link in the episode's show notes and also in our social media channels. Second notice, this podcast was recorded in front of a live Zoom audience, and as part of that, we take some questions from the listeners towards the end. My thanks to everyone who came along. Here's the program. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is episode CLXXXVIII. That's becoming really unwieldy. How to win a consular election. Every year, Rome held an election in which two senators were chosen for the role of consul. Being elected consul was a great honour, and the position was hotly contested, and a successful campaign depended upon the candidate's military achievements, rhetorical skills, and their willingness to be corrupt. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Hello.
I got that in one go.
Don't give away that it normally takes a few.
Normally takes more than a few. Okay, so Rhiannon, let's broadly start. And what was a consul?
Consulship is the top magistracy that you can aspire to in Rome. So it's the highest political office. And I suppose people would align it to president. It's a limited term, much more limited than I think any terms we have in modern democracies. It's just 1 year. Consuls are really powerful. They hold imperium, which is the Roman word meaning power. It's the word we get empire from. It is supreme power. You can command armies. You can send them into the field. You can interpret and execute laws, very loosely described as enforce order. Goodness knows what that could mean. There are, however, limits on this, not just the 1 year term, but also the fact that there are two consuls. And they can veto one another. They can veto lots of things, specifically one another. And that means that, in effect, Rome can be, for a long time, very conservative. Because if one consul wants to do something drastic, the chances are the other consul won't let them.
Yeah.
You're always bearing in mind that after your term of office, you could be prosecuted. This leads to some curtailment of power, ideally during the Republic, that there are checks and balances, as they're called.
Okay, just as a kind of thing, what was the thinking behind two consuls? Was there a reason behind the number? Was it a Romulus and Remus kind of thing?
That is one of the theories. Yeah. It is one of the things that's argued about, that it represents the old kind of status groupings of patricians and plebeians. Mm. But in the early consulship, we know that it was held by two patricians. So that doesn't work for Origins. Romulus and Remus is one. Broad theory that they brought in the Republic and the consulship, according to kind of legendary history, in the late 6th century when they threw out the king. So they didn't just want one person in power at any point.
Yeah, okay.
So it's also about that division of power. So the consulship is also associated with the expulsion of the kings in 510 BCE, so the rejection of tyranny.
And while it sounds like, you know, great, king is gone, we're bringing democracy in, the disclaimer is that it's only the real rich, well, it's still the real rich, I guess, who can run successfully for the role of consul.
Yeah, I would say that whatever the demerits of our political systems, that it was much more limited to the very wealthy in the Roman Republic in terms of who could run and really who had the power in voting. Mm. It's true that, you know, it takes money. If you've got money, it certainly helps a lot, and more so in the Roman Republic. But it's a very complicated voting system.
Well, if every Roman, in theory, had the right to vote.
Okay, so straight away, we need to asterisk that and say it's only male Roman citizens.
Yeah.
So you've thrown women out from the democratic group straight away.
Okay, so you've asterisked that by saying that, but if you obelisk that, does every Roman still have the right to vote?
They do. Yeah. They have the right. Whether they can exercise that right and how much that right is worth,
yeah,
is worth going into. So they vote in these, what we might think of as colleges or assemblies, they're called. It's called the Centuriate Assembly. Originally, it was groups of 100 men. So in Latin, the Comitia Centuriata. And this centuriate system groups them into what we would think of as electoral colleges.
Mm.
Now, this seems to have been originally based on their tribal system and also aligned with where they stood with regard to the army. So if they were cavalry, which means they are more elite because they've got a horse, hence equites, then they are in a higher grouping versus the infantry, and eventually those who don't even take part in the army get a grouping as well. But if you are higher up that status grouping, which comes to be based upon property by the time we're talking about in the late Republic, then your centurion gets more votes. So your centurion, which isn't 100 people by this point necessarily, gets together and says, we vote for Julius Caesar.
Okay, so you're giving your vote / electing your local representative almost. It's sounding very American with their electoral college.
It's not a local representative. It is more like the presidential system with caveats in that I'm sure I don't know all the ins and outs of the presidential system, but that your state will vote for a particular person and then all the votes from your state go to that person.
Yeah.
Right? So all the votes from your century go to that candidate. But if you are the very, very top property qualification elite, then your vote is worth maybe 100 votes. And if you are the very, very bottom status, no property at all, then your vote is worth maybe 2 votes.
Okay. Yeah.
So
yeah.
You have it heavily weighted in favor of those with property is the short and simple and cutting through it all way of saying that. And certainly in some elections, by the time you get to the lower status centuries, it's already been decided.
Okay.
Also, you have to vote in person. All right. So none of this postal vote nonsense. You can't send somebody in your stead. You have to get to Rome. You have to vote in
to Rome. That's a hell of a commute.
It could be for some people, especially in the early first century BCE, the whole of Italy is enfranchised, essentially.
Yeah.
They're given citizenship. So, you know, unless you've got the money and the ability to travel from the very toe of Italy up to Rome for that one day, it takes money, it takes transport, it takes being able to be away from your job, farm, whatever.
So everyone in the empire can theoretically vote.
When they're enfranchised. So it's a gradual process because originally it's Rome and then it's Latium and then it's brought into Italy. And there are citizens throughout the empire, you're right.
Yeah, yeah. But they have to get to Rome. You go all the way to Rome, you vote, you see Livy, and then you go back.
Is that the celebrity you're going to see?
That's a very obscure reference.
Yeah, I know. From the elder Pliny saying that. Did they travel all the way from Spain?
Yeah, they did. Yeah. I don't see many people as being bothering to be that dedicated, but they've also made it very hard to vote. Good to know. Okay,
we just have to go to our local primary school. A lot harder in Rome.
So we've got the money kind of aspect and needing to be landed. Is that the kind of criteria for standing for consulship?
Yes. Standing for consulship means that you should already have had a magistracy. So you're already a senator. So the traditional career path is that you go through being quaestor and praetor and maybe other magistracies too.
Mm-hmm.
And then you stand for the consulship. You're meant to be at least 42. By the time we're talking in the late Republic, these rules have already been broken. They've been broken for people like Marius. They've been broken for people like Pompey. And so they're starting to fall apart. It's going to completely fall apart soon. But those should be the rules. And the greatest kind of glory you could hope for is to stand for the consulship in your year, i.e. you're 42.
Mm.
All right. So that's when you want to do it and to be able to say, I got the consulship in my year. I didn't have to hang around until I was older. But you do need money, partly for what we've already talked about. And we'll talk about more for bribery, basically. And you do need the esteem of your colleagues because they're senators, they're from that top group, and they're going to affect the people around them. And as we've already mentioned, their vote carries more weight.
So if you're trying to appeal for voters, you're trying to canvass the vote, is it worth approaching anybody who isn't a rich elite man?
It is. It definitely is. The candidates know that it is worth cultivating those, what we might call ordinary constituents.
Mm.
So because both candidates, or usually more than two, usually come from those elite status groups anyway, they're going to split the vote of their peers. They need to make the case to all classes, as we would think of them, that it's in your interest to vote for me, or maybe not even I'll give you something, but look at my ancestors, look at the glory they have accrued. I'm the right person for the job. Look at my military achievements. They carried a lot of weight in going for the consulship. Or maybe you owe me. I've done stuff for you in the past. So there's a bit of quid pro quo from the past, from potential future, and a lot about the esteem of you and your family that you can use to attract what they thought of as the mob.
Yeah. Okay. All right. The mob.
they literally call them that, the turba, the crowd, the multitudo, the
multitude. My valued constituents. We've now broadened that. I'd love if politicians called them mobs these days. That'd be accurate. We have a good example of a candidate running for consulship when Cicero stood for office in 63 BCE. He wasn't really a traditional candidate, was he?
He certainly wasn't. He was what they called a new man, a novus homo. And I'm going to do the joke I always do at this point, which is a very 90s joke. It didn't mean that he did the washing up. He wasn't that kind of new man, metrosexual.
Oh, boy.
But he was...
This is why there's editing, folks.
Oh, I think that should make it through. Please vote for my silly joke.
I thought my Obelix one was bad.
No, he was a new man in that nobody in his family had been a consul before. He came from a non-senatorial family. They were equestrian, which doesn't mean he's not from the mob, okay? His family has vast amounts of money and property. He's not from Rome itself, but that's not particularly odd by this point. But it's something he'll make a virtue of. He comes from the simple old Arpinum. But yeah, the fact that his family hasn't been involved in politics at this level means that he's going to have to rely on other skills. Also, he has no military career to speak of, so he can't talk about those glories. He's really only got one thing that his candidature relies on, and that is his ability to speak and speak persuasively. And by that point in 64, when he's getting ready for standing for this consulship of 63, he is known as the best orator in Rome. He has defended and prosecuted some really important cases.
So
those people owe him to start with. And this is going to be really important to him because he's standing against two other people. All right, so one of them is going to lose out because the three candidates for two positions. It's take it or lose it in Rome. He's up against famously, infamously, Lucius Sergius Catilina. So Catiline, we tend to know him as.
Yeah.
Who's from a really old patrician family, and he will make a virtue of that. And also is very much attracting the mob. He's making these populist moves.
Mm.
And against a man called Antonius Hubrida, who is Mark Antony's uncle. Plebeian family, but of very high status, and they have had lots of magistracies in their family before. Spoiler, Cicero will win.
Mm.
This is why we're talking about it, alongside Antonius. So they will edge out that really most high status man, Catilina.
So we're left with a good guide of how Cicero could have succeeded in winning the consulship. This is a handy how-to guide written by his brother Quintus. And everyone with siblings would be well aware of the fact that your siblings like to tell you how to do your job. Yeah. Who was Quintus? Why was he writing this? And is this a case of him telling Cicero how to do his job?
Yes to all of those things. He's a younger brother too.
So. Oh, that just makes it worse. That really does.
And this guide, I should hedge at the beginning and say there have been questions over authorship through the centuries. It's possible it was written by someone else later, even knowing that Cicero did get through. I think most people think it is written by Quintus Cicero now. It seems very much up on the kind of issues that are around at the time. And so I think it is a good guide to what a candidate would have gone through, even if not written by Quintus Cicero. It is addressed to Marcus Tullius Cicero, the eventual winner.
Mm.
And it very much says, look, I know you probably know all this stuff. Obviously, you know, you've got all this prestige, you're the best orator, so you don't need advice on that count. But let me give you this advice anyway. Let me tell you largely who to try and appeal to, who to try and butter up, who it's worth spending your time on, and how it's worth spending your time on those people. We tend to call it the handbook or the pamphlet on electioneering, the Commentariolum Petitionis, little commentary. It's a little notebook on electioneering, and it is quite short. You could read it in an evening very easily.
Okay. All right. What kind of advice did Quintus give?
Well, I like the very beginning of it. If you can't be bothered to read all of it, read the first bit because it's very funny.
Listen to this podcast.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to read it out to you anyway. He basically says, and this could be advice to some of our candidates, I think, focus.
Mm.
Like, just keep your eye on the prize. And he kind of rounds it up. There's a sort of ring composition. He ends with this too. Consider what city this is, what it is you seek, and who you are. Every day or so, as you go down to the forum, you must repeat to yourself, I am new, that word novus, new man.
Yeah.
I seek the consulship, this is Rome.
You're so, pointing at me. I feel like I'm in trouble. So,
it's just those three things. I don't even know if that's on the camera. I can't see myself deliberately. But yeah, those three things. I'm new. That's a kind of downer. You don't want to keep repeating only that.
Yeah.
I seek the consulship. That's what my focus is. This is Rome. It's very pithy. It's even pithier in Latin because, you know, they never need as many words. Quintus kind of starts off with not minimizing the problems of being a new man. All right. So we would be aware of this anyway, I think. But Quintus goes into this in a little more detail. He basically says, don't worry about it, though. Your fame as an orator will make up for it. So I kind of already mentioned this, but it's not just the fact that Cicero is very good at speaking. It's the fact that he's known for it. And a lot of this pamphlet will be about fame, reputation, what you're known for, and will be set up against what your opponents are known for. Mm. And they're, you know, they're just scum of the lowest order, according to Quintus Cicero.
Yeah, yeah.
And what this ability with speaking has done is allowed Cicero to make friends. That word friend, I think, is probably the most frequent word in this work. And it means more than people you go down the pub with. It means people that will do something for you and you'll do something for them. So
oh,
it was
yeah,
a quid pro quo.
Yeah. The political friend.
And it's friends from all social circles, all right? He says, make it clear to them there will never be another chance to those who owe you a debt to thank you. This is when you pull the debts in, or for them to put you under an obligation. So this is a chance for you to get me to do something for you, folks.
Mm.
And this, of course, includes people he's defended in court. Call in that favor now. This is the time.
Definitely. Yeah.
You know, you weren't paid for those efforts because it would have been disgraceful for a lawyer to be paid in Rome. They do it all pro bono. This is the time that they can pay you, in effect, without it being shameful, because there's no money involved, except, of course, there is money involved in other ways.
All right. So skills as a public speaker is fine. And that is something that Cicero very much has to his advantage. But I think that we know from the current world that there's many a political leader that has proven that they don't have to be particularly eloquent to get anywhere in politics. So what other skills did Quintus say you need in order to win a consulship?
All right, so this great oratory isn't going to be enough on its own. The elites in particular need to know that you won't sell them out, that you will be their man, not just the man for the underlings, the populists, because you don't come from their class, so they're going to worry about that. Ironically, Catiline, who does very much come from their class, is going to appeal to those underlings, the mob.
Okay.
So there's a kind of reversal going on here. And you could say it for Julius Caesar in the next decade as well. Very briefly, what Quintus is talking about here is the difference that we tend to class as optimates and populares. So the best class, the optimates, see themselves as those who will support the Senate and the power of the Senate. And the populares are people who appeal to the people. So again, Catiline, Julius Caesar. You can't really make it as broad as that. And, you know, sometimes people we describe as optimates have appealed to the people too. These are political strategies that people use. But what he's saying here is basically tell the elites that you are one of the optimates.
Yeah.
Make sure that they know that where it seems like you've been a bit populist, really you were just following someone like Pompey. All right. And that's good as well because Pompey is popular. Pompey is seen as now broadly one of the optimates, but he's incredibly popular with the people. So you kind of, I do think of this as like saying, well, they, you know, that bully told me to do it. That's why I was a populist back then, because Pompey said it was a good thing to do. that idea that you reassure them, it's okay to stick their vote with you. You won't sell them out.
Yes.
You will make sure that their interests are fulfilled.
Okay, no, that all makes sense. And in the grand spirit of every man having a vote, how broad did the term friendship get in this how-to guide?
Reading between the lines, given what is going to come up in sort of the second half of it, it means very broadly those in your social class and maybe a little bit lower, but not the multitude. Anyone who shows you goodwill, who can do something for you, all the mob can do is vote for you. So I guess they can do something, but they can't provide money. They're not going to be patrons who have clients who can be told to vote for you. That is implied, although not spelled out exactly.
Yeah.
They're part of your network. Quintus says, work your networks, your family, your neighbors, your own clients. And then he says, go what seems to be below Amicus, I think, freedmen and even slaves. Even slaves. Now,
even
they can't
slaves?
Vote. They cannot vote.
Yeah, but if they're down at the pub talking about how great Cicero is.
Yeah, they can affect your household's reputation is specifically what Quintus says.
Yeah.
So they can say, oh, I know that Cicero, I know his slave, and they all say he's a great bloke or something similar.
Bloke.
That he is, I don't know what they would say, that he's orderly, that he's all for order in Rome, that yeah. kind of thing, that he's not going to overturn, which is something people worried about with Catiline and would arguably come to bear during Cicero's consulship, that he won't overturn the established order. And, you know, I think we continue to see this. People don't always vote for something that would be directly in their interests. So someone like Catiline might be offering them debt reduction or might be offering them more power in some ways. But then they might be told, yeah, but, you know, that's going to cause possible violence or civil war in Rome. So vote for order.
Mm.
And this is something, you know, Cicero is trying to bed in, I think, that you will get continuity with me. You'll get stability.
Okay. All right. So what about negative tactics then? What could you turn against your opponents?
Well, he's got some harsh words for these opponents in particular. And we know that the political fight in Rome could be full of invective. It could be quite nasty, down and dirty in terms of words, and no one can do that better than Cicero. So when I say he's a brilliant orator, that doesn't just mean that it's full of flourishes. He will use those horrible terms and make implications about people's, especially their moral suitability for these roles.
Yeah.
He's done that in his prosecutions and defending people, and he puts that into practice here. And this is what Quintus tells him to do, denigrate the opposition. Bring their private lives up, show people how dubious it is.
Mm.
He says Antonius and Catiline are both assassins from boyhood, both licentious, it's a great word, both spendthrifts. Now, these are three things to attack people for. They're violent, right? And we've had violence in Rome. We don't want that back. They both got lax sex lives, he's basically saying, with licentious. And they're both really loose with money. They might have lots of money or come from moneyed backgrounds, but they're not very good. I mean, how good are they going to be at preserving the finances of the Roman state if they're spending their father's fortunes?
Yeah.
That's the implication of spendthrift.
Yeah, yeah.
He accuses Catiline of incest with his sister, which is a popular thing that Cicero likes to throw in one case in particular that's going to come up in the 50s. He says that they're torturers and murderers. Worst of all, Catiline has lived with actors and gladiators. So those from the lowest of the low. And contrast them with your blameless life. This reminds me, it's much more subtle now, but of, I think it was an election advert that our prime minister put out where very prominently shown was his wedding ring.
Yeah.
And the leader of the opposition is divorced. And
okay.
That was, I don't know how many people in Australia are going to care about this these days. So many people are divorced, single. That's clearly what he's trying to imply there. I'm a family man. I'm a stable family.
Yeah, yeah. Or just social media images that current leaders will put out of them assembling a chicken coop that they bought from Bunnings. I'm a family man. I can play the ukulele and sing poorly and cook a curry with the best of them kind of thing.
This is very specific for those not in Australia. And again,
yes.
I think all about our Prime Minister's current campaign. So yeah, show them how blameless. And for us, it's often normalizing, isn't it? Doing those normal activities. I have to say, I don't do any of those activities, but that's what that's meant to convey. The last thing Cicero wants to convey is that he's a normal bloke. It's very different in Rome, but that he leads this morally upright life.
Yes.
And also use scare tactics. He specifically says this, would any citizen, I like this image, is want to, this is a quote, to unsheathe with one vote two daggers against the state. So that's very specifically saying these blokes will give you violence. Now, of course, this is really disingenuous because whoever wins, if Cicero wins as he does, he's going to have to rule with one of these other people. There are only three candidates and there's two positions.
Mm.
So when it comes to it, he's going to have to make some kind of arrangement with the other consul, which he does with Antonius. So this is all going to have to go away after the election. But
yeah.
At this point, absolutely go out to get him. I guess it's like the primaries in a presidential election in the US.
But part of the theory behind having two consuls is that one will keep the other in check if needed.
Yeah. And often, certainly what happens here is Cicero says to Antonius, I'll deal with what's going on politically, locally.
Mm.
You kind of deal with the provinces. In exchange, you can have this province afterwards. I'll make sure that happens. So yeah, it doesn't actually mean both of them are invested in the same issues and will check and balance each other because they can come to that kind of agreement.
Yeah. And it's a very long election campaign, so you've got a long time to slander the other candidates,
yep.
Talk yourself up. and wait for the other person to make a mistake, I guess.
Yeah, that's always the case, isn't it? It is a long election campaign, you're right. Quintus says, you know, this is a 2-year slog, basically. You need
two years.
Well, that's what he says.
When the consulship is 1 year.
You need to have been making people grateful to you for the last 2 years.
Yeah, okay.
So it's a big investment. You're right. You're only going to get 1 year of power out of this, but it's a lot of power. And he tells him, you know, really be strategic. Decide who's worth spending your time on. Cultivate those who are already popular. If people are disliked or particular groups are disliked, there's no point in cultivating them. Get to know what he calls the sodalities, gangs involved in electoral bribery, effectively. They're now clearly an accepted part of political life. So however much Cicero is going to say, I'm against bribery, I'm against corruption, he's also making use of those channels because you can't get to power without them.
Yeah.
Bribery is just an established part of the election here. And this is something that Quintus accepts and sort of implies that it's no slur against Cicero to make use of them.
Mm. These all seem very accepted kind of tactics. You know, everyone knows what's going on.
Well, I mean, if you think about the phrase that gets used in the Australian media that's sort of accepted, there's pork barreling, which is you throw money at the marginal electorates. I was listening to a discussion this morning about whether that's corruption, and to a certain extent, it is, because you're using money to buy people's votes.
Yeah. And it goes on, and everyone knows it goes on. Okay, so tell me then about how you approach your enemies. What is the psychology that's at play here?
Yeah, psychology seems to be deeply embedded in this guide to how to get elected. Quintus says, get to know the methods and types of your detractors and your opponents. So think about what they're going to do, and I guess be one step ahead. If you think anyone on your side has cozied up to the opposition, so they've basically betrayed you, and then they try and clear themselves, he says, just pretend you haven't noticed. So be above it all, I guess. Say you never doubted them. He says, nobody can be a friend if he thinks that he does not come up to your standard. So I think this is very clever, because you could be angry, you probably are angry with that person. They've gone over to the opposition and then realized maybe it's in their interest to come back to you. But there's no point in being angry at them.
Yeah, ultimately you need their vote.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you've offended someone by defending their friend, no, Cicero.
This is a very specific Cicero example.
Yeah. Most of the other people standing for the consulship may have done this, but this is what Cicero's reputation depends on. All right, so you say, well, I had those personal obligations. This is the kind of friend I am. Make that a strength. Make it something that shows your moral virtue. But when you are on their side, when you're consul, you'll defend them just as well.
Mm.
All right. So make a virtue of it and make it something that will attract their vote. This is something that Cicero almost certainly had to overcome. He'd been involved in lots of prosecutions, for one thing, and there must have been friends of even people like Verres, who'd been the governor of Sicily and was prosecuted in 70 by Cicero and was widely despised, but he probably had friends and supporters too, because he's from the elites.
Yeah.
So you have to kind of try and get around that. I was doing the thing that was right at that time. So he's really kind of thinking about what's going on with the opposition too and how to win them around.
Okay, so that's when dealing with the elites, and I guess that is the main concern of somebody running for consulship, because their votes are worth more. Those are the people that you're going to be working with, slash trying to impress, slash trying not to be knifed by later on, prosecuted by, maybe more likely. Does what the people of Rome want matter during a consular election? You said they can vote. You said their votes count, kind of. And I guess this is a tactic that Julius Caesar would use later on, appealing to the populares. And you said that Catiline did it in this election.
Yeah, didn't work for him.
Yeah, but still, is what they want matter?
Yeah, it does matter. And it matters increasingly because I think there's more of an expectation. It's been building for decades that things like what I mentioned before, debt cancellation and appealing to the masses, means you can accumulate enough votes to swing an election or to help. Quintus is very strategic about this. If you read it, chapter 41, it's like a whole new section. He says, so much for friendships. Let's now talk about how to deal with the people. So again, no pretense they're going to be your friends. What he says this needs is not so much, not even so much of the quid pro quo, I'll do stuff for you, because as one of the optimates, the best people, that would be beneath Cicero.
Mm.
It's flattery. Being attentive to them. Remember people's names, he says. He says that so frequently throughout this work. I'd be terrible at it.
Yeah, I wouldn't be very good. Whatever your name is.
Yeah, exactly. That will impress them. I think it's true. be attentive, be generous, or at least look generous, make political promises. That one, you know, stands the test of time. Publicly put on a show of some kind for them. And Quintus is immediately worried by the word flattery, because that's a kind of shameful thing to be ingratiating, to use what he calls blanditia, flattery. Mm. It's usually considered a fault because it's like making yourself servile to someone, sucking up to them, I guess. But you need it for canvassing, he says. And if you pretend it enough, this is interesting, it'll come naturally.
Yeah.
You'll start to be able to do that. And just bear in mind, you're doing it for a good reason. Right, you're doing it to achieve this ultimate power, which kind of balances it out, because the imperium that comes with the consulship makes you servile to nobody. You are above everybody, at least for that year.
Mm-hmm. So could you promise to give things to the people? Could you be generous with what you say you're going to do during your consulship?
Well, you could, and other candidates did, but Quintus seems to advise against this year, and I think it's because of the kind of candidate he wants Cicero to be, which is to appeal more to the elites. Mm. So he kind of phrases the generosity part quite carefully. He says, it's not that your generosity can touch the people, or not the kind of generosity you're going to show, i.e. you're not going to say to them, the handouts will go up. It won't benefit directly, but they'll hear about how nice you are to your friends, and that'll give you a good reputation. Now, this advice, as I say, it's meant for a candidate of specifically the kind that Quintus Cicero wants Marcus Cicero to be, but it's not what's going on amongst other candidates, and I think it's going to be dated very quickly, because by the 50s, offering something to the people is quite effective, and it will happen, and it will certainly work for Julius Caesar and others.
Okay. All right. So make the promises.
Make the promises. Make yourself approachable too, is something else he says. So not so much you're saying to them, I will give you this, but make it look like they can approach you with their pleas, with their demands. And he says, I love this phrase, not only through the door of your house, you can expect them to clamor at your door, which sounds like hell to me, but through your facial expression, which is the gate of the mind.
Mm.
So politicians need to look like they care. I think this is good advice for candidates now. They don't always, do they?
No, it's a hard skill. You've got to have charm, and some are really charmless. Again, no
names.
No names at all. Insert name here. Okay, the other thing that I'm kind of curious about is publicity. And we do actually have examples of electioneering slogans in Pompeii, for example, where they've been preserved. So that kind of thing was around. So if I wanted to write in 10 feet tall letters on the wall of a temple, vote for Cicero, then I'd probably be arrested and made to write it out 100 times. But it is kind of possible, isn't it? That sort of thing was done to some extent.
It was done. It's hard to know to what degree it was encouraged by the candidates themselves, or if it's coming from below, because we have no mention of it here. So there's no kind of handing out of pamphlets. You know, we get them in our letterbox at the moment, telling us vote for this person because this is their policies and this is what they're going to do.
Here are your preferences.
Yeah, specifically
one,
to Australia. No. Exactly.
Last place, Catalan.
Definitely Catalan at the bottom there. They didn't have preferential voting in Rome. It's just you vote for one person and that's it. First past the post. But Quintus says it's not a problem for you anyway, Cicero, because you're already famous as a brilliant orator. You're popular in Italy, probably because he comes from the regions. He does bring up here again, it's this kind of your celebrity endorsement. Remind them that you've backed Pompey in the past and that he supports you.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the equivalent would be. We get celebrity endorsements sometimes. I don't know how successful they are.
Okay.
But, you know, from sports people.
You want to give yours now?
Oh, if only I could be in that category. No. So invoking Pompey is a good way to do it. And also he's got the military achievements that Cicero doesn't have.
Yeah.
He is seen as a safe pair of hands. And do the dirty on your opposition. Spread scandalous stories about them, basically about their crimes, lusts, and briberies.
Okay, so this is all pretty much during the Republican period of Rome. So how did becoming consul change during the imperial period? It is a lot less to do with election, isn't it?
It certainly is. The whole political system is upturned, of course.
It's a party favour.
Yeah, it is. It becomes an honour rather than something with power, because power resides with the emperor. The emperor has tribunician power, which is the power of the veto, and a whole lot of other honours and powers too, and a lot of authority. And during that period, the emperor often was consul, or maybe his son was consul. And then you get to a stage where you have consulship changing. So not year by year, but because it's such an honor, you give it to someone for 6 months and someone else for 6 months, and then it gets down to month by month.
Yeah.
And these people, they have honor, they might have some authority, but the position itself does not have imperium in the way that it does during the Republic. In 190 CE, Commodus, Boo Hiss, man from Gladiator, Commodus' praetorian prefect Cleander is choosing the consuls, and he appoints 25 in a single year. So presumably that is two for each month plus one.
That's a couple of weeks each turn. Yeah.
One of them being the future emperor Septimius Severus. So I guess it could be a route to being emperor if you get enough upheaval as they had after the reign of Commodus.
Well, I guess at that point, you know, being consul, the fact that you've had that title still holds sway.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Otherwise, why would so many people want it for just 2 weeks at a time? So my takeaway is that becoming a consul is very much about power, persuasion, and corruption, and it isn't transparent, and there's very little honesty involved, and that the ends justify the means.
Yeah, and I think to a certain extent, political campaigns are still very much like that, in broad brushstrokes. And right at the end, Quintus returns to his "This is Rome" theme. He says that again, and he says, look, we just got to accept there will be bribery. To sum up, use your reputation as a fearsome orator, remind the people and the elites that your enemies are corrupt, that there are some centuries that will return a candidate that they like even without bribery. You might not even have to bribe everyone, which is like amazing. Perhaps some of them will go for you anyway. The very last thing he says is be all things to all people. This just sounds so, yeah, so
thanks,
disingenuous.
Thanks, Quintus. Thanks.
Yeah. you, the Senate has to think you're always going to be for authority. The equites, who he hasn't really mentioned throughout, but they must think you're devoted to peace. The masses must think that you back their interests and you've got esteem.
Okay. All right.
It's very cynical, isn't it?
Yeah. Terribly disingenuous kind of realistic view of it all. I hate it. Thanks, Quintus. Appreciate you leaving us with that. All right. So we're now going to take a couple of questions from you, lovely listeners. We will start with Seth McGregor. So Seth asks, if I was a Roman citizen who drank, gambled, and ate away every single sesterce to my name, had no close family and no home, if I then got in trouble with some guards, would I be able to express my citizenship and save myself from a beating, or would the guards just do it anyway?
Ooh.
It's got nothing to do with consular elections.
Well, technically saying I am a Roman citizen should allow you to have the rights of a Roman citizen, which means that you have the right to a trial. And we know that all of these rules and regulations are, especially in Rome, I think, whatever rules there were, we think of them as very legalistic, but we also know that they didn't always abide by their laws. So I don't think that's always upheld. But Cicero had famously said in one of the trials I mentioned there, the trial of Verres, the corrupt proconsul, governor of Sicily, that he had beaten up one of the locals, a Greek local, or had him beaten up, even though he was saying, I'm a Roman citizen. So Cicero used that against Verres, the fact that somebody had said that, but that he had been severely beaten, I think, to the point where he died, even though he was saying, I'm a Roman citizen. So technically, that should not happen to you if you say I'm a Roman citizen and you don't have to prove it. But the reality of it, clearly not so clear cut, unfortunately.
All right. So a question from Alexander Barrett is, are there any contemporary records or later records on the number of citizens voting in specific elections? Do we know?
We don't have anything on that, I'm afraid. In fact, we have very little even on how many centuries returned for Cicero in the election for the consulship of 63, that kind of thing. That would be brilliant. But no, sorry.
Follow-up to that, James has asked, is do we have any margins that the consuls won by? Do we know, landslide victories or anything like that? Or
we don't have records that are that good. We only have mentions in, say, something like the letters of Cicero. And of course, he's more concerned about himself. So we know that he got more votes than anybody else in that election. So we do know that much, but it's kind of anecdotal. And of course, Cicero has some kind of interest in telling us that. So even though he's the new man in that election and he's up against two very elite men, not only does he manage to win alongside Antonius, but he gets more than, I think, the other two put together, I think he says.
Okay.
So whatever Quintus told him, if he followed it, it bloomin' well worked because it was no bar to him. I mean, it's at a specific time when the other two do look scary, but it does work and he gets more votes. So we get it on that basis, but we don't have any official records.
It's at least good to know that, you know, out of all the consuls that won that year, he won the most.
Yeah, yeah, I guess so.
That's something.
Yeah, he certainly managed to persuade the elite. Yeah. Otherwise, he would not have got in.
All right. A question here from Sharon Waddell. What did Crassus, this is a bit specific, get out of lending Julius Caesar vast sums of money? What would Caesar have done to repay Crassus?
Well, this is something that you could potentially promise, I guess, in an election. It's a bit different with Julius Caesar and Crassus and Pompey because they're in that extra constitutional unofficial triumvirate. And what Caesar offers to both Pompey and Crassus is specifically things that will keep them popular, and it is land for their veterans. And because he's going to be consul after he leaves Gaul, then he can make sure that those things happen, that their troops are well taken care of.
Yeah.
So that's the quid pro quo there. And yeah, Crassus can also be assured, and he needs Pompey's support with this as well, that he will be allowed to go prosecute this fight eventually in Parthia, which doesn't work out well for him. But because the consul can put people in the field, then you need to have that support. So that's what Crassus gets out of that. Even more cynical than helping someone be consul, that triumvirate, because they're helping each other, not just for 1 year, but over a period of time.
All right, so a question here from Matthias Bueno regarding the two consul system. Was it natural to have an unofficial senior between the two? The more popular consul would be able to pass more laws, etc. And how that relationship changed in the empire years when you would have an emperor acting as a consul. I guess the good example that comes to mind here is the relationship that Octavian / young Caesar proposed with Cicero when he wanted the consulship after the death of Caesar.
Yeah, so you're thinking about around the time of the Battle of Mutina.
Yeah. We've done episodes on those recently, and that came up. He wrote to Cicero suggesting, you know, we could be consuls together.
Yeah.
You be the more senior, I be your young Padawan. I think I use that term in the podcast recording. Off we go.
Yeah, and this is something that I perhaps should have mentioned, is that there is that understanding that there is always a senior and a junior consul in some respects, and it's meant to depend on who gets the most votes. So it's kind of surprising we don't know more about that, isn't it? But what they expect is for it to be an older and younger one, I guess. So if you get the consulship in your year, you're probably going to expect to be the junior one, but Cicero wasn't. And Cicero was voted in his year. He was 42 that year. Given that he got more votes, he would technically be the senior one. But as I say, all of these supposed systems are kind of being disrupted by these little arrangements that the consuls will make together, that they won't co-rule. You know, the other one will get something in exchange for not really ruling.
Yeah.
And then by the 50s, when Julius Caesar is consul, he stops Bibulus, his co-consul, from being consul at all by sending gangs around to frighten him and keep him at home. So
yeah,
Bibulus never gets to vote.
Yeah.
So, you know, hence the joke. It was the year of the consulship of Julius and Caesar. Yeah. We're getting towards a point where none of this system is working correctly, but that's how it's meant to work. And the Romans heavily depended on this kind of mentoring system. So that's how oratory worked. So Cicero had lots of mentees that he worked with to supposedly make them good orators, good politicians.
A lot of good questions here, people. This one here from Grace McKenzie McHarg. Women could not participate in politics, but how involved were they behind the scenes?
They were, and again, though, the degree to which this is happening is very difficult to judge. And I think we do get swayed by what the TV shows we watch. So, you know, the influence they might have in Rome. And is it Domina that's being referred to here, the one about Livia?
I haven't seen it.
They can potentially be involved in bribery.
Mm-hmm.
They will, of course, support members of their family, usually. And they can have authority and influence. It's all unofficial. But they can sway people. They can bribe important people. We know that there were female orators. Now, this is really disappointing because we don't have much more information than that. We do know that women went out and spoke in public. But again, it's a big knowledge gap because we don't have men talking about it very much. We kind of have a list of names.
Mm.
And it's quite possible that they were perhaps making an appeal for candidates.
Okay. Moving on here, Carolyn Auburn asks, were the consular votes held on the same day every year? And if so, what was the turnaround time to come into power?
It changed during the mid to late Republic. So the consulship started on the 1st of January in the late Republic, but before that it had been in March.
Right.
So the elections were usually held in December. It's very close. Maybe late November. There isn't a specific date, but it's a matter of weeks before the consulship begins on the 1st of January. So no messing around. You count those votes, you're straight in.
Yeah.
And presumably they could do that very quickly because they didn't have to deal with digital fails or anything like that. And if there's corruption, I don't think there's any record of a recount.
We'll take a couple more questions here. Jan Pauline Pohl asks, do groups of people or volunteers also campaign for a particular person, or was it just left to the candidate to campaign for themselves?
Now, there is campaigning. Now, again, I can't give you specifics here, but we can take from what Quintus Cicero is saying and what we see elsewhere that this is what these networks are for. Mm-hmm. So people will kind of unofficially campaign for you. All right. So you create those networks. You have all of these friends that you call indebted. You're not just looking for their vote. You're looking for them to influence those around them. And you can't overestimate that patron-client system that operates in Rome, that social system and economic, I guess, where patrons will financially support and maybe give authority to their clients. And they would expect their clients to vote the way that they recommended.
Mm.
That's part of the quid pro quo they would expect, especially if they're standing for office. But those who favored Cicero, those who favored Pompey, would expect their clients to do the same. So it's kind of, I wouldn't say there are volunteers, because that sounds official. It's more about these webs moving outwards. If you can get those networks working for you, then you effectively have a group of volunteers doing that work for you. It's not all left to yourself. On the other hand, there are no political parties, so it's not like you've got the Republicans funding you. You are funding it all yourself.
Yeah.
And hoping other people will give you money too.
Which is, you know, why the wealthy and elite usually only ran for office. On that note, we'll finish on this question here from Andrew Douglas. Matt mentioned in his opening that there were two senators that were elected consul. Was that always consistent throughout the Republic / Empire, or did non-senators ever become consuls?
I mean, that's kind of what a new man really is,
yeah.
That they've had no senatorial background. But Cicero had still gone through those other magistracies. So in effect, they are in the Senate by then. Technically, they could. The military experience can get you there.
Yeah.
So I think, and I'm sorry, I haven't gone and looked this up, but I think that's what got Marius there.
Mm.
So he had just been a very successful military leader. Pompey's in this category as well to a degree. So Pompey gets to be consul very young in his 20s. Big rule breaking there. And that's because they had had huge military achievements and were seen as having saved the Republic in some way.
Yeah.
So it's only for exceptional people. Part of what Cicero is kind of basing his reputation on is that he's doing it by the rules. He's not breaking the rules like these people, right? He's waiting until he's 42. He's had other magistracies. Yes, he's a new man, but he's gone through the ranks properly. And he's really hoping this kind of behavior can save the Republic, and he's sadly misguided.
All right, we're going to wrap up the podcast now. So do you have any parting words of wisdom or advice for those who are experiencing elections or have impending elections in their areas of the world? And
use your vote wisely.
Yeah.
Don't be swayed by sweet words.
That was Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may cast your pod. Please leave a review. They are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.